You're listening to ESL Podcast English Cafe, number 267. This is English as a Second Language Podcast, English Cafe, episode 267. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff McQuillan, coming to you from the Center for Educational Development in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Visit our website at eslpod.com to download a learning guide for this episode that will help you improve your English and give you whiter, brighter teeth. It's true. On this cafe, we're going to talk about violence in video games and some of the ways that American parents are trying to make sure their children don't play video games that are too violent. We're also going to talk about a program called ROTC, or the Reserve Officers Training Corps, which is a program that has been in existence for many years, a well-known but sometimes controversial program at American universities by the U.S. military. And as always, we'll answer a few of your questions. Let's get started. This cafe begins with a discussion of video game violence. Video games have become common in many homes in the United States, especially those with families or older single men. 40 years ago, they were very simple video games. When I was a child, we had games like Pong and Pac-Man, but over the years, they have become much more complex. Actions such as fighting, shooting, and killing are now very common in video games. And the games have a lot of realism, meaning that they seem very real or lifelike, in part because of the technology now is better so that you can make things look more real, including acts of violence. Some people are concerned, parents in particular, that the realism of video games will make people insensitive to violent actions that occur in these games. Insensitive is the opposite of sensitive. If you are sensitive to something, you can tell the differences, you are affected by the differences. If you're insensitive, you don't see the differences or are not affected by this. What some people are saying is that, for example, if a player in a video game kills another character or player in the video game, he or she will become less sensitive, more insensitive, to the act of killing when it's part of the game. And maybe, and here's the controversial part, the part that people don't agree on, maybe in real life as well. Some people believe that seeing these kinds of violent actions in video games will encourage people to do similar things in real life. They will hurt or kill other people. One of the first controversial video games was a 1976 game called Death Race. I honestly don't remember this. When I was in high school in the late 70s, I remember playing video games, one video game called Space Invaders. And to play the game, you had to go to a store or restaurant that had one of the games. You put in a quarter, 25 cents, and you could play the game for, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes, I suppose. That was the only video game I have ever played. And that was, well, 30 years ago plus. I was in eighth grade in 1976, and I don't remember this game, Death Race. In it, the players controlled cars that ran over different kind of monsters, fictitious animals, things that weren't real. Now, this might not seem very violent, especially compared to today's games, but it was a controversial game. The popular American TV news program called 60 Minutes spent time talking about it. Some groups tried to create laws in the early 1980s to restrict or to limit how close places that had video games, especially video game arcades, could be to schools. An arcade, a video game arcade, is a place where people used to go and play video games, just like I described. You would put a quarter or 50 cents into a big machine, and then you could play the game. Some groups that tried to pass these laws thought that the games would make children violent. Researchers have studied whether violence in video games can have an impact or affect people's views of violence, of what is right and wrong. Many studies do not show a connection, but some studies do. Some studies have experimented with teenagers and children, giving them violent video games to play, and then noting how aggressive their behavior was afterwards. Aggressive means that you are perhaps violent, or you are very assertive of yourself. You are willing to do something to defend yourself or to attack another person. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. That is, it's probably not the case that watching a violent video game will make you go out and shoot your neighbor. But it's probably also true that it does have an effect somehow on the way that you look at violence. Violent crime in the United States declined a lot in the 1990s when video games were getting more and more violent. However, these statistics are a little misleading. That is, they can give you the wrong impression. You can get the wrong idea from them. Part of the reason for that decline was because there were fewer and fewer young people, and therefore fewer and fewer crimes. Also, some people say that the economic health in the 1990s, the economy was growing with lots of jobs and so forth, and this might have also been part of the decrease in violent crime, regardless of what the video games were doing. Well, in 2005, the state of California passed a law that made it illegal to sell certain violent video games to minors, people who are younger than 18. However, the law has been challenged, and it will be one that will be discussed by the most powerful court in the United States Supreme Court, this year when we are recording this episode in 2010. The Supreme Court will decide whether this law is constitutional, that is, whether it goes against the rights of, for example, free speech in our Constitution, in the U.S. Constitution. Beginning in the early 1990s, the video game businesses created a rating system. This was first established in 1994. A rating system measures something on a certain, what we call scale, a certain range. For example, movies in the United States can be rated G, which means they're for a general audience, children, old people, criminals, cat lovers, anyone can see this movie. It's okay for everyone. Now, if a movie has more violence or sexual content, it might be rated PG, which is only for those who are, for example, over the age of 13. Or it might be rated R, only for those over the age of 17. Video games have a similar rating system based on how violent the game is, typically. There is a group called the Entertainment Software Rating Board, the ESRB. This is not a government group, it's a private group. And they look at all of these video games and give a rating to each game. They look at the language and the violence. They look at how much blood is shown in the game. The rating system is supposed to help people know what kind of game they are buying and decide whether it's a good idea to buy it for their particular children, referring to adults, of course. The game's ratings are on the box, so you can see when you buy it whether this is a game for an adult, for a teenager, or for a young child. Interestingly enough, the rating system is not mandatory. That is, video game companies don't have to use the rating system on their games. It is voluntary. However, most companies put the ratings because many stores will not sell the games unless they have ratings, because they don't want parents complaining that they bought a game that was very violent. And when that happens, the parents are unhappy and often want their money back. So the stores will not sell the games unless they have ratings. In addition, many console manufacturers, that is, companies that make the machines, the consoles that are used to play the game, like PlayStation, for example, will not even license games for their systems unless they have an ESRB rating. To license here means to say it is okay to play this game on my machine. Since I grew up after the popularity of video games became more widespread, especially games that you play at home, I don't really have a lot of personal experience in these violent video games. It seems, again, reasonable for a parent to want to make sure that his or her child doesn't watch things that are very violent. We normally don't let our young children watch violent movies because we know that it can affect them, it could bother them, it could change their views on things. So it seems reasonable that a parent would want to know how violent these games are. But that's just my opinion. On our second topic, we're also going to talk about a controversial program or issue. Today we're going to talk about ROTC, which is the Reserve Officers Training Corps. An officer is a leader, usually in the military, the Army, the Navy, and so forth, the Air Force. ROTC, sometimes called ROTC, is a program that is offered at most American colleges and universities to train students to become future military officers by taking special classes that focus on leadership, problem solving, planning, and ethics. what is right and wrong. The ROTC program is used by many branches of the U.S. military. When we say branches, normally we are talking about what comes out of a tree. The tree has different branches, different parts that go in different directions. Here, branches just means divisions or parts of something. The U.S. military has an army. It has a navy for the ocean. It has an air force for planes. It has marines, who are special kinds of fighters. And it has the Coast Guard, which guards the coast of the United States. Students who participate in ROTC, if they graduate, if they take these classes, can, when they finish their school, be considered for higher rankings, higher positions in the military because they participated in this program. Why would someone want to participate in this program? Well, some young men and women want to serve their country. They want to help the country in the military. There's also the benefit of receiving scholarships, money from the U.S. military to pay for their college education. However, if you are a member of ROTC and you accept these scholarships, you need to agree to spend a certain number of years after you finish school serving in the military. Now, not all ROTC participants have to serve in the military, but it is required if you accept money. If you say, I will take your money to pay for my college education, and after I will serve 4 years, 5 years, I'm not sure the exact requirement, in the U.S. military. The ROTC program produces officers for all of the U.S. military branches that I mentioned, except the Coast Guard. In fact, more than half of the officers in the Army are from ROTC programs. These were students in college who joined the program and then went into military service. Similarly, high percentages are also true in the Air Force, 41%. It's less true for the Navy, 20%, and not as common for the Marine Corps. Only 11% have leaders, officers who were in an ROTC program. The Marine Corps often attracts men, young men and women, who don't have the same level of education. The Marine Corps is considered perhaps the most difficult in terms of its training program for its young men and women. How did this program get started? Well, it was actually first created back in the 19th century as part of the Morrill Act of 1862. Now, the Morrill Act was one of the first pieces of federal or national legislation, one of the first laws that dealt with creating colleges and universities in the United States. The University of Minnesota, where I went to school, was created in part by, or as a consequence of, the Morrill Act. In fact, we even had a building on campus called Morrill Hall. The act or law was about more than ROTC, but ROTC was part of that law. It required that when the government gave land to different states to create colleges and universities, that these schools include some military training for their students. This training became known as ROTC. ROTC is now offered, as I said, at most American universities. In fact, in the past, some universities required that all male students participate in the ROTC program, even if you didn't want to go into the Army, even if you did not accept a scholarship, you still had to participate in the training, in the classes, and so forth. However, in the 1960s, as people became more upset about the U.S. participation in the Vietnam War, many universities changed their policy and made ROTC voluntary. You didn't have to do it. Some schools even stopped offering ROTC. There have been other reasons why some colleges did not want to offer ROTC. Beginning in the early 1990s, there was a policy in the U.S. military, which still exists as of this recording in fall of 2010, called Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Now, I talked about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in English Cafe 225, so I won't repeat that, but it basically says that if you are gay, that is, if you are homosexual, you cannot serve in the military if you are open about it. That is, if you are actively part of that lifestyle, that way of living, and you tell other people. If you tell someone that you're gay, the military can remove you from service. However, they won't ask you if you are gay. You would have to tell them, or they would have to find out some way. It's a very unusual policy, and again, listen to Cafe 225 for more information on that. The policy, of course, was controversial. Many American universities did not want to have the policy supported, and so they said, okay, well, if you're going to have this policy, we're not going to allow ROTC on campus. Well, the federal government had an answer to these colleges. It said, okay, if you don't have ROTC on your campus, then we won't give you any money from our Department of Defense. This law, called the Solomon Amendment, was passed in 1996. Most American universities, however, were accepting money, and they needed this money that the government was giving them. And so many of them changed their policies in order to allow ROTC on their campuses again. I was not a member of ROTC. I had a friend, or someone I knew in high school, who joined ROTC. This is in the early 1980s, and was a member of the military. There are even some high schools still today that have what are called junior ROTC programs, where the high school students themselves participate in this military training. It's still found at some private high schools in the U.S. There was a movie in the 1980s called TAPS, T-A-P-S, about a high school that had a program like this. Now let's answer a few of your questions. Our first question comes from Paolo, P-A-O-L-O, in Italy. Paolo wants to know the difference between should have done and should have to do. Well, should have indicates something that was expected in the past, something you were supposed to do yesterday or this morning or last week, earlier than right now. Should have to means should be required. It isn't necessarily required, but it should be. For example, a student should have to correct their mistakes if they get an answer wrong on their homework. They should have to. they might not. Teachers might require it. Some do, some don't. But I'm saying that they should have to do that. They should be required. Should have refers more to something, as I mentioned, that was expected in the past but did not take place. They should have given him an award for giving such a good speech. They did not give him a reward, but they should have given it to him. Or you could say, my wife should have been home by now. She should have, she was expected an hour ago, but she is not yet home. In American speech, you almost always hear should have as a contraction, should have. In fact, when we're talking fast, it really sounds like shoulda. He shoulda called me means he should have called me. Should have to, however, is never spoken as a contraction. Native speakers will pronounce the entire word have when they're using that particular expression. The contraction should have is sometimes confused, even by native speakers, to mean should plus the preposition of, O-F. However, it is not a contraction of should and of. It's a contraction of should and have. A contraction, of course, is when we take two words and we put them together in a special way, usually by using an apostrophe as part of the punctuation of the sentence, or the word, rather. Regine, R-E-G-I-N-E, in Germany, wants to know when we say only and when we say just. What's the difference between the word only and the word just? Well, both words can mean the same thing. Just can mean without any others, alone, solo. There were just two cookies left. There were two, and that was it. No more. You could say, there were only two cookies left. It means the same thing. Both words can also be used in place of the word merely. For example, my ankle isn't broken. It's just a sprain. It's only a sprain. It's merely a sprain. Sprain is when you hurt some typically muscles around the bone, but the bone isn't broken. Merely is used to mean it's not as serious as you are saying. It's less severe. It's less serious. Or it's lower in degree. For example, that's not a computer, it's merely a monitor. It's just the video projection system, but it isn't actually a computer. That's how we use the word merely. Just and only can also be used in that way. There are some differences between the two words, however. Just can mean very recently, a few moments, a few minutes ago. My brother just arrived. He arrived at my house 5 minutes ago. He just arrived. You cannot say he only arrived. That would be incorrect. Only just can be used in that case. Just can also mean exactly, such as in the expression, that is just perfect. Finally, only can mean alone in a group, single. He's an only child. That means that the parents had only one baby. He's an only child. You can't say he's a just child. That would be something different. Or you could say, Tim is the only kid in class who got an A, who got a perfect score. Finally, Janus, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that word, J-U-N-U-S-Z, in Poland, wants to know the meaning of the phrase, to learn as one goes. For example, I'm learning as I go. This means to develop knowledge or skill about something as you do a particular action, even though you don't know much about it when you start. But the idea is that if you continue to do it, you will learn better how to do it in the future. We usually use this phrase when we don't have all of the knowledge and skills we need to finish some task, some thing, some action before we start. So, for example, maybe you do not know how to cook. Well, you can start and experiment and learn as you go while you are cooking, while you are doing that action. And eventually, you will be more knowledgeable. You will be more fully prepared. We do not want our doctors to learn as they go, to say, I don't know anything about medicine, but I'm willing to cut this person open and look inside. That would not be a good idea. It would be a good idea, if you have a question or comment, to email us. Our email address is eslpod@eslpod.com. We don't have time to answer all of your questions, but we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. From Los Angeles, California, I'm Jeff McQuillan. Thank you for listening. Come back and listen to us next time on The English Cafe. ESL Podcast English Cafe is written and produced by Dr. Jeff McQuillan and Dr. Lucy Say. Copyright 2010 by the Center for Educational Development.